the reading, Matthew chapter 8, verses 23 to 34. Then he got into the boat, and his disciples followed him. Without warning, a furious storm came up on the lake, so that the waves swept over the boat. But Jesus was sleeping. The disciples went and woke him, saying, "Lord, save us, we're going to drown." He replied, "You of little faith, why are you so afraid?" Then he got up and rebuked the wind and the waves, and it was completely calm. The men were amazed and asked, "What kind of man is this? Even the winds and the waves obey him." When they arrived on the other side, in the region of the Gadarenes, two demon-possessed men coming from the tombs met him. They were so violent that no one could pass that way. "What do you want with us, Son of God?" they shouted. "Have you come here to torture us before the appointed time?" Some distance from them, a large herd of pigs was feeding. The demons begged Jesus, "If you drive us out, send us into the herd of pigs." He said to them, "Go." So they went. So they came out and went into the pigs, and the whole herd rushed down the steep bank into the lake and died in the water. Those tending the pigs ran off, went into the town and reported all this, including what had happened to the demon-possessed men. Then the whole region went out to meet Jesus, and when they saw him, they pleaded with him to leave their region.
What kind of a man is this? Even the wind and the waves obey him. That's the question that the disciples are left asking halfway through our passage for today. And it is in many ways the question that we should be asking as well. When we look at Jesus, who do we see? What kind of man is he? Just a couple of weeks ago, I received a reminder in the post to go for an eye test to see if my prescription is still right, to see if I'm still seeing clearly. And when we come to passages like this, we need to check that we are still seeing Jesus clearly, because it's all too easy over a period of time for our understanding of who Jesus is to become a bit hazy, to become a bit short-sighted or myopic. And when that happens, the result is that we underestimate Jesus. Now, to help us, as we look at these verses for today, they're there on page 973 if you want to follow along, we will see two portraits of Jesus' power and his authority. And in doing so, we'll see two reminders of why it's not just the wind and the waves and the evil spirits who listen and obey Jesus, but why you and I should listen and obey as well. If you were with us last week, you'll remember that Jesus' disciples, that's the word for his followers, they were given some very clear teaching on what it means to follow Jesus. And what we see today is that in following Jesus, the Christian believer should not expect an easy ride, but can be sure of a secure one. I've got two headings for us this morning, and the first one is this: it's Jesus is God and he will protect us. Jesus is God and he will protect us. First heading then, you will have noticed as Anthony read it for us, the setting for our verses today is Lake Galilee. So verses 23 to 27, they take place on the lake. And then verses 28 and following take place on the other side of the lake. But it all begins there in verse 23, doesn't it? With Jesus getting into a boat and his disciples doing what disciples do. That is, they follow Jesus into the boat. It was most likely a fishing boat. You may know that four of Jesus' closest friends, they were all fishermen by trade. But in verse 24, we read that without warning, a furious storm came up on the lake. And the seriousness of that situation is really emphasized, isn't it? We're told that there's waves sweeping overboard. The sailors feel that they are in great danger, so much so that they are convinced there can be only one outcome. There in verse 25, "Lord, save us, we're going to drown." That's why they wake Jesus up. It's an interesting choice when you stop and think about it, isn't it? Jesus was a trained carpenter, not a sailor. But although the storm is furious, although it's far beyond the control of the others in the boat, we see it's not beyond Jesus' control. We're not told how the disciples thought that Jesus might save them. But here, Matthew, who's written this down for us, he wants us to be in no doubt that Jesus gets up. He rebukes the wind and the raging waters, and then the storm subsides and all is calm. Now, of all the stories in the Bible about Jesus, I guess this is one of the most classic Sunday school ones. And some of us this morning, we may well be too familiar with this. Some of you will know that as a family, we spent last week visiting friends in Switzerland where we used to live. Now, I knew that there would be mountains there and lake there. I'd seen them before. We lived there for 3 years. But as the plane comes into land, you're still blown away by the majesty of the mountains. You still marvel at their beauty. Well, friends, as we come to this passage, as we look at Jesus calming the storm, we should once again marvel at what Jesus does here. You and I, we struggle to even predict the weather, let alone control it. So along with those in the boat, what Jesus does here should bring the same reaction. Verse 27, when they saw us, they were amazed. Should lead us to the question, what kind of man is this? Even the wind and waves obey him. I don't know if you've heard the story about King Canute. In the 11th century, he was the king of Denmark, England, Norway, and a bit of Sweden. And an English historian called Henry of Huntingdon wrote a story about the king in his Chronicle of the History of England. Now, he wrote in Latin, but thankfully it's all been translated into English. And here's what he writes. The king, this is King Canute, commanded that his chair, his royal throne, should be set on the shore at the beach when the tide began to rise. Then he spoke to the rising sea, saying, "You are part of my dominion, and the ground that I am seated upon is mine. Nor has anyone disobeyed my orders with impunity, without punishment. Therefore," said the king, "I order," he's talking to the sea, "I order you not to rise onto my land, nor to wet the clothes or body of your king." But of course, what happened? Well, the sea carried on rising as usual without any regard for who he was. It soaked his feet and it soaked his legs. And then moving away, the king said this, "All the inhabitants of the world should know that the power of kings, presidents, prime ministers, is vain and trivial, and that none is worthy the name of king but he whose command the heaven, earth, and sea obey by eternal laws." Apparently, after that episode, the king never again put the crown on his head. Instead, he fixed it above a picture of Jesus nailed to a cross, turning it forever into a means of praising God, the one true king. Now, that story illustrates for us, doesn't it, that King Canute understood something very clearly, that even as king of a bit of Sweden and Norway and Denmark and England, he can't control the wind and the waves. Only God can. Of course, that wasn't King Canute's idea. It's something we're reminded of again and again in the Psalms, in the Old Testament of our Bible. I've got a few of them coming up on the screen. We won't go through all of them, but perhaps the most relevant is Psalm 107, because in the verses before that, we hear about sailors being at the sea, and they're being thrown around in the storm, and they're described as being at their wit's end. They think they're going to drown. What do we read though? "Then they cried out to the Lord in their trouble, and he brought them out of their distress. He stilled the storm to a whisper. The waves of the sea were hushed." Sounds familiar, doesn't it? It's familiar because Jesus on Lake Galilee does exactly what the Old Testament tells us that the Lord God Almighty can do. So the point is clear, isn't it? Who is this man, Jesus? Well, he is divine. He is God. But we need to ask the same question. Are we seeing him clearly this morning? It's good to ask ourselves that. Have we grasped Jesus' awesome power over his creation in this way? How there's nothing out there in the world which is beyond his power. Jesus still retains power over this world, just as he did on that lake 2,000 years ago. He's not changed. So Jesus is never just a miracle-working man. He's never just a good teacher. He is the God-man with the power to control nature and to protect his people. So they need not fear. Jesus is God and he will protect us. Seems to me that that's why Jesus questions their faith there in verse 26. It's not that they have no faith. After all, they go to Jesus for help. But I think Jesus' question highlights that they've not fully recognized who Jesus is, not fully grasped his power. They understand him to be powerful, but not divinely so. That although no doubt the storm is a great one, that they might have trusted him more as the one who is supreme over creation, as only God can be. So their faith is not little in that there's not much of it, but it's little because it does not make much of Jesus' power. They think Jesus' power is little. They underestimate him. That's why they're amazed at what happens. Even the wind and the waves obey him. It's also why they need not have been afraid, because Jesus' power provides protection. It guarantees their protection. You see, faith is not a commodity that we possess. It's not that some people have it and others don't. It's not about how much we have. Rather, it's all about what or who we put our faith or our trust in. We thought about this a bit last week, didn't we? You go to sit on a chair. Before you sit on it, you realize that the chair, it's making a promise to you. It's saying, look, if you sit on me, I will support you. Might even be quite comfortable. Now, if we have little faith in the chair, we won't sit on it because it doesn't look like it can keep its promise. We might be scared to sit on it. If we have great faith in the chair's ability to keep its promise, we will sit down because as we look at the chair, it looks strong and sturdy and supportive. Well, what we learn from this episode is not only who Jesus is, but what it means to trust in him. It teaches us that if we have little faith in Jesus, we will see him as a miracle worker, a healer, and a teacher. We will follow him, but we won't trust in his power and his promise to protect us. If we have great faith in Jesus, that is to say, we do trust in his power, we trust in the Jesus that we see here in the pages of our Bible, then no matter what we face in life, we will trust him to protect us because we understand that he's God. The Christian author, Don Carson, writes this: faith chases out fear, or fear chases out faith. What he's getting at is that there is a faith, a true faith that is fearful, and a faith that is fearless. And the difference is not about who we are, what type of a person we are, what home we grew up in, where we live, or how we think. The difference between fearful faith and fearless faith is all about who we understand Jesus to be. And so if we put our trust in Jesus, we need to ask, are we putting our trust in this Jesus, in the God-man Jesus, who even the wind and the waves obey? The enormity of Jesus' power, that may no longer surprise us, but it should settle us. It should drive out fear. Now, it seems to me that we're not to read this account and assume that Jesus will calm all the storms of our lives. God doesn't promise that. And in fact, this very story demonstrates something of what following Jesus actually involves. Remember, Jesus got in the boat, the disciples, the followers, they followed him. Didn't mean there wasn't a storm, but it did mean they were safe in the storm. So I don't think we should conclude from a passage like this that actually our illness will go away, a relational difficulty will be resolved, all troubles will just disappear and all will be calm. No, no. For the Christian, our confidence is not that the storms of life will end very soon, but that in the midst of the storms, we will never be alone. See, God Almighty, incarnate in the person of Jesus Christ, he will be with us every step of the way. I wonder if you're familiar with the little story, Footprints. It's coming up on the screen. I don't know if you could read it. I wasn't sure how familiar people would be with this. But to be honest, as a teenager, I thought it was all a bit naff, a little bit twee. After all, it was on our fridge magnet at home. But actually, it does have a profound truth and a beautiful one, because it highlights the tendency to think that Jesus has abandoned me. When times are tough, Jesus is nowhere to be seen. When in actual fact, it is that he has the power to carry me through them. That's what we see in this passage. Thanks, Joe. So great faith, it's not a Christian confidence that difficulties won't come our way as we follow Jesus. Jesus spends a lot of his time teaching us that they will. But great faith understands that no matter what comes our way, God himself is right there in the boat with us, if I can put it like that. And his power will see us through. It's why the Christian believer has a confidence that we will be in heaven and the new creation beyond. That's not a confidence in ourselves. That's a trust in the one who can control the wind and the waves. First point then. Second point, Jesus is God and he can restore us. We pick it up at verse 26, 20, I need to see the optician, 28, when we were reminded that they've made it to the other side of the lake. And so having followed Jesus into the boat and through the storm, the disciples now find themselves in Gentile country. That's the Gadarenes. Remember, the world at this time divided into two groups of people, Jews and Gentiles. They've gone from Jewish territory into Gentile territory. They've gone through the storm and they're in Gentile country and they're in a graveyard and they've got a herd of pigs roaming nearby. So the followers of Jesus, they were Jewish by birth. That's not the sort of place any Jew would ever want to find themselves. Away from home, pigs, unclean pigs nearby, hanging around in a graveyard. What are you doing there? And yet here is Jesus. And then we're told two demon-possessed men meet him. It's perhaps worth pausing there for a moment and saying that God in the Bible, he doesn't tell us much about demon possession. It's rarely mentioned in the Old Testament, and there are a few examples after the Gospels, after the four historical accounts of Jesus' life. Not a lot said about it, and yet there are various passages, like the one we have before us this morning, which clearly teach that the devil and other evil personal spiritual beings do exist. And there's two things we can be sure of from this. The first is that such evil spirits, they are in the business of destroying people. And they're also very much opposed to all that Jesus is doing. They bring destruction and opposition. But although they are opposed to Jesus, he is never outwitted by them. Because whereas they are limited, none of them are his equal. That's clear, isn't it, from our verses. Throughout this encounter, it's Jesus who's in charge. It's Jesus who's in control. He's the one with the power and the authority over this evil. So as real as their possession is, so is Jesus' power over them. So we see how Jesus not only commands the forces of nature, but also the forces of evil. What kind of man is this? Well, he's the kind of man who's very good news for the two men who are demon-possessed. Because the picture we're given them, it is as tragic as it is scary and chaotic. They are living amongst the tombs. That wasn't a popular place to be. They were considered a danger by others, marginalized and avoided by people in the town, and considered a menace, a danger to all who came near. If you ever go to a zoo or a safari park, you may well come across a tiger or another animal in a cage. And on the one hand, you're sort of fascinated, aren't you, by they're just beautiful tigers. But at the same time, you've got that nagging idea in the back of your mind that they're not in their natural habitat, that they weren't created to live in that sort of a cage. Well, as we look upon these two men, made in the image of God like all humans, and yet that image has become so very distorted, hasn't it? Well, it's tragic because we know they were not created to live like that. But what is crystal clear is that Jesus is the one with power, power to set them free, power to restore them. There in verse 29, they're begging with Jesus, aren't they? The demons are begging Jesus not to torture them, not to bring them to judgment, to the appointed time. Something they seem to know is inevitable. They just don't want it yet. So they suggest an alternative, those pigs nearby. Well, notice that they require Jesus' permission to do this. As much as they are opposed to Jesus, they're quite powerless to do anything without his permission. And so in verse 32, Jesus tells them to go, which they do immediately, and they go into the pigs, which then drown in the lake. Now, there's no getting away from the fact that this passage raises a few questions which are not answered. I guess the big one is, well, why the pigs? Does Jesus not like pigs? And what about the cost to the farmers? All their livestock have just drowned in the lake. Well, we're not told the answers to those questions. But there are several things which are very clear, I think. The first must be that the good of these two men is clearly more important than the pigs, and that Jesus permits rather than sends the demons into the pigs. So with our 2019 hats on, we might be a bit surprised at this sort of agricultural disaster. I don't think that's because we value pigs too highly, but we do need to ask ourselves, do we value even one human life too lightly? Because like Jesus, I think we should say, well, it comes down to the men being restored or the pigs. Well, the men win every time, don't they? The second thing I think is clear is that this also shows us where evil ultimately leads. So it's less of a reflection on Jesus' attitude to animals and much more on the devil's attitude to people. What is abundantly clear is that Jesus is in charge and that no one is beyond restoration. I don't know if you like car restoration programs, Car SOS, Car Sausage. Do you watch that? I don't know. I love that sort of thing. But basically, they take a knackered old car, and if you've got enough time and money, the right tools and the right skills, and a man called Fuzz Townsend, then you'll be able to restore it to its factory condition, even better than that. Just this past week, I had the opportunity to see a 65-year-old car that had been beautifully restored to factory condition. It was a Mercedes 300 SL Gullwing, in case you're interested, a remarkable vehicle. But as beautiful as that restoration was, as I stood in the garage looking at it, how much more beautiful is what Jesus does? You see, a mechanic, they can restore a car, but they can't restore people, especially damaged, broken people like this. Jesus, as he was growing up, he trained as a carpenter how to build and restore furniture. But because Jesus is the Son of God, he can build and restore people. That's what we see here. Remarkable restoration of these two men. But there's a scary bit to this as well, because we see that it's possible to completely miss the point, to not see Jesus clearly, to not see that Jesus is God and that he can restore us. We're told in verse 34, the whole town came to see Jesus. We might imagine how delighted everyone was, such a fantastic demonstration of Jesus' power, how he can turn people's lives around for the better, restore that which is broken. Wow, Jesus, what an amazing miracle. Thank you so much for coming. Look how you've restored these two men. Praise the Lord. But they don't. They want Jesus to leave. It's because they can't see the wood for the trees. They can't see the miraculous restorative power of Jesus for the pigs. So they completely miss the point. And that is a dreadful condition to be left in, to reject him rather than welcome him. Again, it's vital we see Jesus for who he is and just what he can do, and then respond in the right way to him. Not turning him away as these people did, despite what they see before them, the power of Jesus to change lives for the better. We saw earlier, didn't we, how Jesus calmed a violent storm. Now he's calmed these violent men. And in both cases, he just speaks. And there is immediate and dramatic change. And he is the very same Jesus we come before this morning. When he speaks his word, it changes us. He takes evil out of our lives. It may not be as dramatic as what we see here, but he promises he will do it, and he has the power to do so. So we won't find ourselves in the exact same situation as these men found themselves in. And yet we may be here this morning feeling like we are in a very dark place. Just this past week, we found ourselves doing and thinking things we never imagined we would do. And so we may be tempted to feel we are too far gone for Jesus to restore us, tempted to fear we are too far gone for Jesus to rescue us. And so however we got here, we are stuck here. But the wonderful news of what we have in Matthew chapter 8 is that there is no place so dark and gloomy that is out of reach for Jesus. And so if that's you this morning, can I encourage you to speak with someone afterwards? Pray with someone afterwards. Because what we are reminded, the Jesus we have before us this morning, is that he has the power to restore us, to bring restoration and rest and comfort and assurance. There are no spiritual forces. There is no evil which won't have to surrender to Jesus or which has the upper hand. The Apostle Paul writes in Romans 8, "Nothing in all creation can separate us from God's love, neither angels nor demons." So as Christians, we can pray with confidence, "Deliver us from evil," because we know that Jesus can. Just as I close, notice how the demons, they fear Jesus because they know his power. Sometimes we can be just the opposite. We fear because we forget the power that Jesus has. And yet, as we've seen in these past couple of weeks, he's the Son of God with all authority over disease and disaster and demons and death. And so the Christian is the most secure person in the whole world, because our security is not based on our job or our house or our wealth or our health. We are secure simply because we are in the hands of Jesus, in the hands of the one who has all authority and power in the whole world. And he loves us and he cares for us. What kind of a man is this? Well, Jesus is the God-man, and he has the power to restore and the power to protect. Let's have a moment's quiet, and then I'll close in prayer.